Hello, I'm Susan Spence. Welcome to this new edition of the Borders Podcast, where you can listen to the latest interviews and news from the world of books, music and DVD, as well as hear about exclusive offers and competitions. This podcast is packed full of features. We have an interview with the wonderfully witty Alan Carr. We'll also speak to Philip Norman, author of the much-anticipated release John Lennon, The Life, and catch up with non-fiction buyer Rob Hughes to talk about the big Christmas biography releases, as well as the usual Lonely Planet travel guide with Tom Hall. Let's start with Alan Carr then. The lovable comedian tells his life story in his new autobiography, Look Who It Is, My Story. He dropped into the Borders studio for a chat, so brace yourself. Here he is on, amongst other things, Hollyoaks, football, Neapolitan ice cream, and sweating.
Hi, this is Alan Dodgen for Borders Podcast. I'm joined by the wonderful, the amazing, the incredible Alan Carr.
Oh, thank you. I didn't recognise myself there, Alan.
Well, you should. Dress as immaculately as you are today.
Thank you.
Yes, well, what's the look today?
You don't think the parasol's too much, do you?
I don't think the parasol. I like the high heels, though.
What about the muff?
Well, I can't see it from this angle.
What about if I uncross my legs?
Lovely.
Wow.
You got that dyed nicely, didn't you?
Yeah, with the collars and cuffs.
Oh, absolutely.
Muff short of hollow.
You see, I could start on what you're wearing today, but let's not even go there in this one. Let's not go there.
What's wrong with my maternity bra?
Just one size too small.
I love a bit of back fat.
Absolutely.
I went and had a test and on your fat, and of course you go there, don't you, and you like breathe your stomach in and all this stuff. She only goes round the back, doesn't she, with these pinchers under my arm.
Oh, I don't like that.
Yeah, I'm morbidly obese round the back.
Absolutely.
Yes.
It's not a good
thing.
Hangs
over the back of my chair like a cape.
In this weather, though, I'm starting to chafe as I run down the street.
Oh, you know what, I'll get this way. Have you ever sat up and then when you've got two semicirculars under your breasts, like two smiley faces?
I'm lucky I don't get that.
Oh.
I don't sweat visibly.
Oh, I do.
I sweat internally, so I go to the toilet like 30 times a day, apparently.
Yeah, and if you've got to have all your water as well, 8 glasses a day, you're always in the toilet, aren't you?
Yeah, I prefer to stick to the alcoholic things.
Yeah,
you know. Much better. Actually, I'm surprised you actually are looking so relaxed today because of the heat. It is quite hot outside.
Yeah, it is. It's very hot. I hate this close. That's what they call it, isn't it?
Do they?
Yeah, close. You know, it's sticky.
Oh, is that what they call it? Close?
Yeah.
Oh, no, I don't know. Oh, God, I don't know these terms.
I'm being interviewed by a retard.
No, not at all. Is it a southern term?
No, it's just a normal term. You've heard of it, haven't you?
It's like when I first came down to London.
I'm asking one of the cleaners. Pam, you've heard that, haven't you? Yes.
Yeah. She's nodding.
Yeah, she's nodding.
But I thought there was lots of southern terms like that, because I first came down there, people started saying, oh, I'm going for a slash. And I thought up north, a slash meant number two. So I thought there's a lot of people with problems here.
Oh, really? No, slash has always been the first one.
It's just me then.
And also Waz.
Yeah, I know about
Waz.
Yeah,
that can be taken.
Going for Waz.
Yeah, going for Waz. Yeah.
Butch way.
Yeah.
Like I do. So you've got a book.
I know.
Where's that come from?
Well, from my very hand. Yes.
Look Who It Is, Alan Carr.
Yeah. Because it's Look Who It Is.
Oh, is that? Oh, sorry. Well, I can't do that.
Bet you can.
What? No, not at all. If I try to do that, people just think I'm trying to do an impersonation of you.
Oh, right. Okay. So look who it is.
Look who it is.
There you see. Oh, well, that's sound looks much funnier.
but is it? Now, this is a biography.
Yeah.
Did you write it?
Yes.
I asked
I'm
that.
Not like Kerry Katona, you know.
Well, you never know. Some people, they don't write these things.
Well, they asked if I wanted a ghostwriter, and I just thought, what's the point of having a ghostwriter? Because I thought, when I, you know, go into Borders and I see my book up there on the shelf, you know, I want the satisfaction of going, oh, I wrote that myself.
Absolutely.
I just don't get it. I don't get why you'd get someone to write about your life.
And how long did it take you to write?
It's been about six, seven months.
Oh, not that long. I thought these books take like years to write.
Oh no! Don't you've got me worried now.
No! I don't mean. I don't know. No, because I've never written anything.
Yeah,
I don't know how long they're supposed to take.
Well, I just sat down. I just sat down and wrote it. I mean, it's only my life, isn't it?
Yes.
No, I mean, I'm not saying, oh, it's only my life, I wish I was dead, but I mean, it's all there, the research.
Yeah, but you know what I mean. It's like where do you start? What bits do you put in?
Well, I started when I was born.
Well, you didn't actually. You started talking about touching trees is where you started.
Oh, right, then, okay.
See, I have read it.
I did have a ghost ride. I don't know anything about it.
Although I did worry where you were going with that touching trees thing. Even when you started talking about the football part,
yeah,
I still didn't work it out.
No.
Yeah, I didn't get that bit at all. But it was like, I can't work out, and I take my hat off to you, because anybody who writes a biography, it's almost like when you read it, they knew exactly how they were going to lay it out.
What, like font, paragraph? Bit of punctuation.
But you knew where
there
to start. I mean, because you start by going straight in about the Friday Night Project.
Yeah, that's the preface. Well, I think that's how people know me, like you said. So I thought, well, I'll just do a little snippet. You see what I've done? I've been really clever. I've written from my birth up to before I do the Friday Night Project. So I've got that whole second book where I can be a real bitch and slag off all those who are vile.
And were there many?
There was many.
Really?
Yes.
But are you going to mention them in that second book then?
Yes. I want to come back a real bitch fest.
Oh, fantastic. A bit like me, really, on the radio sometimes.
That's it, yeah, just like you.
Hmm.
I think I'll dedicate it to you.
Oh, you say these things, it'll never happen. But, I mean, so where did the book come from? Was it something you came up with the idea where I thought, that was the time to do my biography?
Well, to be totally honest, they came and asked me, HarperCollins, if I wanted to write my biography, and I was like, do it. I mean, I'm only like, you know, 27. And we both coughed then together. So I must look really old for both of us to cough. I'm trying to fight the 7 signs of aging. It's depressing with those questionnaires, isn't it? If you don't, when you have to tick the box which you're in, I'm getting further and further to the right of the page.
Yes. Are you in 13 to 21?
Yeah.
And then it never gets to 33.
I'm two away from, would you like to donate your organs?
I hope you say yes.
Yes. Well, yeah, they approached me about the book, and I was like, oh, I'm only them, you know, 32. And I said, what do I want to do? You know, I thought, well, you know, what can I say? And then you go into, like, Borders, like I said, and then you look up on the shelf, and then Kerry Katona's on her fourth one, and, you know, Jerry Halliwell, and, you know, Pete, the one with Tourette's, you know, he was written one. I thought, well, why shouldn't I write one, you know?
Sometimes I sort of think, you see all these books coming out from all these celebrities.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Severely exclamation marks. That's the word I was looking. See, I don't write.
Yeah.
And you sort of think, okay, where did they get the inspiration to sort of write this biography? Did they get approached and things like that?
Mm.
And you sort of sometimes think they're just jumping on the bandwagon of their own fame.
Yeah,
sometimes.
Yeah.
But there are certain people, yourself included in this list, where I suddenly think, that's who I want to know about.
Yeah, well, that's nice, but I do give stuff away. I mean, you know when you read these biographies, and you can tell the ones who've just jumped on the bandwagon. I mean, the autobiographies are the ones that, when at the end, you go, well, I'm no further forward. You know how, you know, mine's honest, it's truthful, you know. And I felt better when I'd written it.
Did you actually bring back memories?
It was cathartic, yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I sort of think, you know, I read something in what you've written, particularly about the football, obviously plays a major part in the book at the start. And you sort of read, I can almost imagine you thinking back to it as you wrote it. Thinking, I remember that bit and, you know.
Yeah. I mean, it is good to look back and at start. I mean, good to get it out, get your sister. And it's funny when you look back as well. And like, there's a bit in the book where, you know, I do sort of like steal other people. I mean, my memory's a bit dodgy, you know, and there'll be bits where you know, I've watched Holby City and then imagine that that's happened to me. And it's sort of like absorbed storylines from Casualty and stuff. I'm going, oh, Alan, that didn't actually happen, did it? And you go, oh, sod it, I'll stick it in.
So you're born in Weymouth?
Yeah. Dorset.
Dorset.
All right, my lover. You say the same as Justin, but no one ever picks up on my accent.
Because you don't really have it.
No, it's just a gay voice, really.
No, it's not. It's just made me slightly camp and effeminate. But I mean, you know,
because you know what I hate? Because people, you see on the internet, people say that me and Justin put on our voices.
I was about to say.
As a gimmick. And you think, if you were going to pick a voice, would you pick this one? And would you pick Justin's? Out of all the voices you could have. I mean, I would be drained if I spoke like this, if I put this on.
Because I think back, I think it was a couple of years ago, you went and did the Royal Variety.
Yes.
And you opened by saying, don't laugh at the voice.
Yes.
And then I suddenly thought, okay, there's obviously something about whether it was an instant paranoia when you were younger or something. I'm getting all psychological here. It's really deep now.
You're like Raj Prasad.
I tell you, I've got a new career coming. It's like almost like you can think some of your jokes, because I know quite a few comedians, and they get their jokes from sort of events that have happened in their lives.
Yeah.
And I was wondering, has that how when you were younger. What am I trying to say here? What I'm trying to say is...
I have no idea.
I don't know. I'm trying to work it out myself.
I'm drifting off, to be honest.
Oh, don't. Don't. Stay with me. Come back.
Oh,
no,
sorry,
no,
my
don't.
Head just hit the microphone where I've tipped forward.
Do you, how many of your jokes are influenced, though, is what I'm trying to get at, by things which have happened in your life? Like,
are you saying... Are you asking if I'm an observational comedian?
That's what I was trying to get at.
That's what you should have just said.
Okay, let's start again.
Now you're just going to
no,
edit
I'm
this
gonna,
out, aren't
absolutely.
You? And then you're going to nick my
absolutely.
Words.
Absolutely. Alan, I've got a great question for you.
I said this already.
I can edit that.
Yeah.
Are you an observational comedian?
I am. My political stuff isn't that hot. I mean, people don't come to see me to hear about Iraq. I'm going to do a political set. I am.
You could do Newsnight.
Yeah, that would be good, yes.
Maybe people will watch it then.
Yes, to the man with a moustache. Oh, sorry, madam.
Stop now.
No, what was I in? Yeah, I am an observational comedian. And I was saying to someone the other day, it's with comedy, it's... you know, because someone said to me, oh, you know, you're reading the book, there's so many comical things happen to you, and, you know, he says, you've had this life that it's sort of like lots of funny things happen, but if you really look at them, they're not funny, the things that have happened are horrible, or awful, like my psoriasis and my mugging, and I got mugged and stuff, yeah, which are down thing, but I look at them as a comedian, if you look at them from an askew point of view, you make them funny, and in a way, that's the way we're dealing with them. So if you look at what I'm actually saying, they're not funny things, but I make them funny, and I suppose maybe that's somewhere how I deal with things. And sometimes I think it's the best thing to do, you know.
Yes or no would have been fine. That's right.
Oh.
Getting in there. In your book, you did go to drama school. Or college, drama college.
Oh, I couldn't get into the drama school because I wasn't talented enough. I didn't have any range, but I did the...
range.
Range. I, in my head, I thought I was a great actor, but I've got no range. I can only play...
Did you go to any auditions, though?
Yep, never got in.
You weren't asked to be the colour purple?
No, all that colouring in with your voice and all that malarkey. But I didn't have any range, and then I just ended up on a drama and theatre studies, which basically meant... moving furniture around in the dark in a black cat suit and then wondering why you never got spotted.
But you had fun.
I had fun. It was a bit of a drag, really.
Yeah.
Painting sets and...
But why didn't you continue it through afterwards? Because after that, your career seems to be a little bit haphazard and you ended up in a call centre.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's no jobs, is there, for actors? I mean, you're up against RADA, and I went to, like, Middlesex University, which wasn't even the acting course, it was drama and
yeah,
theatre
studies. All the course tutors through all the London schools, they all rotate. Alexandra Technique on a Monday's at RADA, Tuesday it's at Central, Wednesday it's somewhere else.
Oh, yeah, that Alexandra Technique, that's all, because if you can be bothered. I only want to be in Hollyoaks.
Is that... Yes, I read that. Why? What, seriously?
Well, I love Chester.
They can't act.
I'm orange. I can't act. I'm perfect for it.
Yeah, this is true. It is Chester. It is
yeah,
Chester.
Yeah.
Yeah, and when you do go up to Chester and we do interviews up there with them, they'll like to like, they're so divas. You're in Hollyoaks, love.
Oh, don't be bad. I've met some of the Hollyoaks people. They're quite nice. But you're going to edit this out, aren't you?
What do you mean they're nice? First of all, you start telling me that you're the bitch, and then you're going to, in the second book, you're going to slate all these people. I start just doing a little bit about some Z-list celebrity in Hollyoaks.
Oh, they're very good friends of mine.
Doesn't mean they're good.
Oh, you are vile.
I'm so going to twist this all round.
You're going to have a field day with this.
Now, I can relate to one thing in your book very closely indeed, which is when you talk about your first kiss in the play. Which was Slave? Was it Slave, the play?
Save.
Save. Beg your pardon.
Yes.
Don't know where I got that one from.
Save.
Because I could relate, absolutely, because I was in exactly the same position. Mm. And I was called a gobbler.
Okay.
That was my kissing technique, was a gobbler, apparently.
Oh, what was a gobbler then?
Well, because I hadn't kissed a girl before.
Yeah.
So I went up to you want me to show you? Wait, is that...
Oh, let's have a... Oh, I see.
So I was called a gobbler.
It looks like you're eating a Neapolitana.
This is the second time you mentioned the Neapolitan
I know,
words.
I love all the three different, what's it, vanilla, chocolate, strawberry, isn't it?
That makes it Neapolitan, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Everybody's just nodding. Yes, Alan, whatever you say, Alan.
Yeah, I mean, it was scary kissing a girl, but yeah, I did it in a play as well, so it was, I had to sexually assault her, Well, I think it was sexually... Well, it turned into... I was sort of like putting my hands where I'd sort of seen it in films.
Whether it was supposed to be or not, you did.
I know. And, oh, God. And I had to be drunk. Then I had to have sex with her. Oh, God. It was...
Hell.
It was hell.
Absolutely.
Like I said in the book, all I needed to do was, you know, swim with a great white and conquered all my fears.
Exactly. And that's what I was trying to get at earlier, is that all the way through the book, all the different things you're talking about, it's almost like, I've got over that fear. Gone.
Yeah.
I'll have that.
Yeah.
Next one. That's right. Next fear. Yeah. And that's great. Because that's how you start off the book, is that fear of first performance on the Friday Night Project.
Yeah.
Half the audience
all,
aren't there.
It's all conquering your fears. Yeah, that's all it is. That's comedy, isn't it, really, in a way?
Yeah, I think so.
Stand-up comedy is definitely getting up there talking about your personal thing. So the jump to writing the book wasn't that, like, you know, you can see the germs of, like, going on stage talking about your life, and in a way, just putting it down in literal form is, wasn't a big deal for me, you know.
Well, as you are a comedian, is there any other comedians out there that you sort of still look up to and aspire to?
I'm not really into stand-up comedy as such, so I don't, there's no one really.
You not do it anymore?
I'll do it, yeah, but I just don't, never wanted to do it. I just did it to get out of the call centre, so I'm not that big, you know, the idea of being in a comedy club all night is hell for me. I can't be bothered.
Oh, well, at least I can still see you though. You're still going out and doing
stand-up. I'm still doing tours and stuff. It's just, it's not me. It's not really me. The first time I was ever in a comedy club was when I was performing on stage. So I'm not. People go, oh, you know, do you always want to be here? And I thought, well, I don't really.
So where's Alan Carr going next then?
Where am I going next? Or rehearsing for a film. It's coming out next
year. Oh, really?
Yes.
Hollywood film?
No, not a Hollywood film. No, it's an English film, really, which I was quite pleased because it's improv, so that's good.
Oh, that's going to be great.
Yes, that'll be good. And I just want to try as many different things as I can.
Okay.
I mean, I know I play someone camp in it. I know I'm not going to be the new cracker. So, yeah, just doing that. And then the film. Then it's coming. Find Out Good Budget's coming back. Sunday, whatever night, Channel 4 stick it on. And then my Ding Dong's coming back. Yes, I'm dead busy.
Oh, Ding Dong is coming back.
Ding Dong's coming back.
So I like Ding Dong.
Oh, thank you. Then I got me chat show next year. Yeah, loads of stuff.
Now, let me ask you about the chat show, because you mentioned that in the book.
Yes.
You mentioned, but I thought it was a joke.
I thought it was a joke, but then that Channel 4 sort of said, would you like to do a chat show? And I thought, well, I'm going to have to sort out my poker face, because I just can't, I find it hard to be sincere.
Well, isn't that what they want, though? They want people to come in and speak their minds.
Yeah, but guests don't want to come on and me being sarky, does it?
Well, I do it all the time, and they seem to keep coming back.
Yeah, well, let's see. Oh, yeah. I think this will be our one and only interview.
Oh, you've got to, nobody wants to talk to you ever again.
No. Yeah, so that's interesting. I mean, it's something else, isn't it?
It's another part to the career path.
Yeah.
Touching trees.
The jigsaw that is Alan Carr.
Absolutely. That's a great analogy, the jigsaw. And all the missing pieces from all the things that happened in youth are now being put into place.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
All the five-piece jigsaw, it's fantastic.
Five-piece? You are a bitch. And multi-layered.
In so many ways. Yeah. In so many
like
ways.
A milk tray box. There's always that second layer.
Absolutely. Keep going with it. One last thing I just want to ask you is obviously... I'm going to go back to the football thing. Are you into football in any way? I don't mean obviously as a player.
No. I watch it when it's on and I support Man City.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's a lady cheering there. You like Man City? Yes!
Why not any of your hometowns?
Well, I always support the team that my dad works for.
Ah, right, so he's at Man City.
Yeah, he's chief scout or something, chief European.
Do you know?
Well, he goes all over looking at men. Blues.
Fine. Okay, I'm a PNE supporter, so...
Who are you?
Preston North End. Nobody knows when they say PNE. I go PNE, like, really proud, and people go, who?
Preston
North End.
Oh, who did someone Worthington used to be their manager?
How do I know?
Oh, God, but why?
I just saw them. I look at them, you know, every Saturday I say, oh, how have they done? They've done very well. You can't ask me about players or managers.
No, all right, you just support them.
Just support
what
them.
What colour are they?
Oh, no.
Oh, my God.
Blue and white, I think.
Okay.
Leave a gap here so I can edit Wonderful. It back in so I can put the extra colours in. Yeah.
Well, just say all the colours and then you can put them in.
Red, white, blue, green.
Got me like a Silit Bang advert. Hey, blue.
Alan, it's been a real pleasure to meet
you.
Oh,
thank you, Alan. It has.
I do wish you the best of luck with the book. Thank you. I'm sure it's going to be a huge success.
This has been another piece of that five-part jigsaw.
I'm part of the jigsaw.
You are.
Oh,
yes.
You see, I just feel so honoured now.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming in, and we look forward to seeing you again for the next book.
Yeah.
Have a good one.
Bye.
An interesting insight into the world of Alan Carr there. And Alan's book, Look Who It Is, My Story, is available now in hardback from www.borders.co.uk. There's currently 40% off, which makes it £11.39, and it's guaranteed to make you laugh out loud. Before we hear from Philip Norman, let me tell you about some great competitions available to enter at borders.co.uk. You can still enter our Young Bond competition, which celebrates the launch of By Royal Command, offering one lucky winner the chance to win a helicopter ride down the River Thames. We're also offering you the chance to win lunch with one of the dragons from the Den, James Caan. One for all you budding entrepreneurs, maybe. We also have signed copies of Michelle Paver's wonderful book, Oathbreaker, to give away, and a fabulous Guinness Book of Records competition where you can win lots of Guinness Book of Records related goodies. All you have to do is go to borders.co.uk for your chance to win any of those competitions. One of the great things about the Borders podcast is the variety it brings. We've just experienced the wit of Alan Carr, and now we're changing the mood to something a little more serious. We all know the story of John Lennon, former Beatle, shot dead on his New York doorstep at the age of 40. But there are so many myths surrounding Lennon that author Philip Norman decided to uncover the truth once and for all in his compulsive biography, John Lennon, The Life. As I discovered when I met Philip, this book is a must, not just for anyone interested in the music legend, but also in life itself. Philip, welcome to Borders Charing Cross Road. Tell us, John Lennon, The Life, what makes this book different to some of the other books that have been written about John Lennon?
I think it is the real life of John Lennon. I think it shows John in all his contradictions and complexities, someone you still end up loving, because the world does love John Lennon. But I think you perhaps understand more why he was the person that he was, the great insecurities that he suffered from, as well as his great confidence and humour and cynicism and wit and all the things we associate with Lennon. Really, about every part of his life, there is new material that hasn't ever been printed. The same things tend to get repeated about these great iconic figures, particularly in pop music. They're almost like myths, you know, the Norse myths of the Vikings around the campfire. And you only have to look, really, and you see that the truth is more interesting, it's more complicated. It still adds up to the great John Lennon, who wrote the music that we all adore and which has such resonance. But about everything, really, from his birth to the terrible moment of his death, there is something new to say.
And how were you able to get to that truth? I know you spent several years researching the book. Tell us how you went about that, because to me, initially thinking about this, must be so daunting about where to start.
It is daunting. I'd written a book on the Beatles called Shout. I made a vow to myself that I would not, certainly not recycle any of that book, but I would not take any of the assumptions of that book either, because it came out over 25 years ago. I would start afresh, so I set myself terrible, really sort of almost impossible standard, you know, that I was going to make a completely new life of John. Of course, I did have connections in the world of the Beatles. I could go to people and say, would you talk to me? Notably to Yoko Ono, his widow, but also to people like Sir George Martin, the Beatles producer, and someone like Neil Aspinall, who really was the fifth Beatle. He was with them all those years as their roadie, and then there's their sort of, you know, most trusted business associate, and ended up running Apple. I could go to those people and say, look, I really want to go back and consider John as an entity, just John, make this a portrait. The Beatles book was really a sketch of four people. This was going to be a portrait in oils, but it was, I won't disguise it, you know, it was a nightmare. because I wanted to do so many things. I wanted to make every page of the book new. Now, that just didn't mean finding out new information, which is in a way the easiest part. The difficult part is to come again to something like the Revolver album, where John's musical and verbal genius really sort of flowered amazingly for the first time. and look again at the whole album, find new things to say about John Lennon as represented in the music. Now, that was the really hard part, because it's very easy, as we know, if anyone's seen Spinal Tap, to write ridiculous hyperbole about popular music. But to write real comment about popular music is very hard.
You yourself then must have been a huge John Lennon fan in order to undertake something like this, because you have to, first of all, have the interest and the motivation, because, as you say, it was extremely hard work.
You have to love your subject. There's no point in, as Albert Goldman did in the 1980s, writing a biography of someone you hate, even if the person is capable of being hateful. I'm not saying John was, but even if the person is a monster, you have to somehow love your monster. You can't just write a horrible deconstruction of someone. No one wants to read it, really. I loved and I still love John, having written this book, and I did meet him a few times as well, and he was always incredibly lovable to meet. But I felt I had to understand him and not flinch from things about him that weren't so comfortable, really, without being scurrilous or horrible, simply to be fair and to take every part of John and consider the tremendous flaws in his character as well as the tremendous strength and the genius, the musical creative genius.
Was there something that you found that even surprised yourself, that you thought, oh my God, I didn't expect to find this out about John Lennon?
Really, for every stage of the story, from the beginning, we know that John categorised himself as a working class hero. I knew that he really wasn't working class. He came from a sort of aspirant, lower middle class. Class was so important when he was born and in his childhood in this country. I really hadn't realized how genteel his family on one side, his mother's side, were. He grew up in a house with servants' bells in the kitchen. They just didn't have living. They would have had a couple of domestic servants once in that house. They didn't when John was growing up. The bells were still there for calling a housemaid into the drawing room to serve your tea. His education, John went down in history as someone who rejected his schooling and had wanted no truck with sort of academic discipline. This was someone completely meticulous, someone who read everything that ever came in front of his eyes, who read every newspaper, who had read English literature to an incredible degree. No one could write a song like Norwegian Wood, for instance, who wasn't to some degree affected by playwrights like Samuel Beckett, Harold Pinter. You know, it's like a little Pinter play, that lyric, you see. So he was someone of enormous, admittedly not formal education, but self-education. All through the story, there's a completely different John is competing for one's attention, as well as the well-known, subversive, funny, rebellious John.
With regards to interviewing, I know you spoke with Yoko Ono. A lot of Beatles fans, clearly, most of them are not really that keen on her. She gets a bad press because she's the one that's been blamed for allegedly splitting up the Beatles. When you spoke with her, does she come across as being somebody who you could see perhaps why John Lennon was so fixated with her? And in your mind, was she the lady responsible for the breakup of the Beatles?
No, John wanted out of the Beatles from a very early stage. He hated the whole ritual of being in the Beatles and people screaming in this sort of witless way, and pursuing them just because they were a sort of brand, they were an icon, they weren't real. They were like dolls, that the world seemed to own. And Yoko was absolutely the right person to give John his escape from the Beatles. Also, what John really wanted was not to be a pop music genius, but he wanted to be an artist. He wanted to be someone who had little exhibitions in galleries in Soho and in New York and in Mayfair in London. And Yoko just said to him, if that's what you want, that's within your power to have it. She simply didn't give a damn. She didn't give a damn for what the world thought or for John's own sort of hang-ups about himself. She said, whatever you want to do, you can do it, and I will help you. So she came along at a fantastically lucky moment for him when the Beatles had just stopped touring and he didn't know what he was doing, really. And within a couple of weeks of the last live gig the Beatles ever did, Yoko walked into his life and that was it.
And with regards to Sir Paul McCartney, their relationship, John Lennon and Paul McCartney's relationship, is, for me, as an outsider looking in, kind of see it as being very volatile, as if they would fall out all the time. And, of course, you know, I would imagine there's lots of creativity going on, banging against each other, which one is the better songwriter. When you spoke with him, how does he speak of John Lennon? With fondness or...?
Yes, with great fondness. And the funny thing about it was that they never really had a row. I mean, they eventually, when the Beatles split up, there was a bit of a slanging match at long distance, so, you know, tracks on albums and that kind of thing. But they never actually had a stand-up row when they were in the Beatles. If you consider the sort of pressurized life they were leading, not only having to perform with the Beatles, but also keep on turning out songs, I mean, dozens and dozens of songs, they got on incredibly well because they were competitive. I always think they were like two people playing ping pong. You know, they wanted to keep the rally going, the creative rally. If one of them dropped the ball, the other one might sort of feel a bit of smirk of self-satisfaction. Mm. But actually, they both preferred the rally to keep going, the creative tension to keep on producing these songs where both of them really were responsible. Even though one might write the song, the other would give a little twist to the lyric or the melody that just gave it the extra something. Even when they had a famous confrontation, when John's resentment, you know, about, as he saw it, Paul's kind of muscling in and taking over and running the Beatles, it wasn't really a row. It was more like someone talking to a marriage guidance counselor about his wife, you know, complaining slightly, you know, oh, you know, you did this and you did. It wasn't really a row. John wasn't, you know, he didn't kind of blow up against Paul like he would blow up against other people at all. And McCartney was very affectionate about him, yeah.
And how were his loved ones that you spoke to, for example, his son Paul, Yoko, how did they speak about the day that he was assassinated and how they felt?
The book ends with John's death. I felt the last sort of, you know, 25, 26 years of sort of infighting and politics within the family, and, you know, nobody really wants to read that. You know, it was about John. It wasn't about after John. I did talk to his son, Sean, who told me his memories of the moment when he was told that his father was dead. They'd been incredibly close. Sean was only five. Mm. But John really had been the one, you know, parenting him while Yoko sort of ran the business side of their enterprise. And it's dreadfully sad, and it's very vivid. You know, Sean saw the world very like John saw the world, and in a way it was kind of like listening to John. We know what McCartney, you know, McCartney was devastated beyond words, but came out with rather a flip comment about it's a drag, isn't it? You know, but, you know, that's what you do in these awful circumstances. Yoko, because they were so close, you know, you can only... you can't even guess what she felt. She did tell me something that was just so poignant, which was that they had had lots of cats. John loved cats. Mm. And when John was killed, by that time they still had three cats in the apartment, which he used to like to sort of sit down, and the cats would always come to him and he'd stroke them. And, you know, he had this very gentle kind of domestic side. And for days afterwards, when the door opened of the apartment upstairs, the three cats would come bounding out to meet him, and he wouldn't be there.
Mm. Yeah, that's very sad, isn't it? Yeah. One of the things I picked up on the book, which kind of gave me little shivers, I have to admit, was when you talk about, or when Yoko talks about how when he was in Japan and he came across a picture of her great-grandfather, and he said, I think it was along the lines of, I can see myself, this was me in the afterlife or the before life, I can't remember which one. And she turned around and said, oh, don't say that, he was assassinated.
That was a dreadfully chilling moment. I mean, it still chills Yoko to this day, because not only that, yes, her great-grandfather, Zenzira Yasuda, who had been the shogun, the emperor's banker, effectively, and incredibly wealthy and famous. But he was also a musician and a poet. And he came from the north of Japan, as John came from the north of England. And he was a kind of hero figure to the Japanese people. They used to put up woodblocks of his image with his wife. He was also very keen on emancipating, giving full recognition to his wife, at a time when certainly Japanese men did not do that, and probably Western men didn't either. but as well as he had been assassinated, he had the same birthday as John.
Oh, really? Oh, that is spooky, isn't it, really? Mm. Oh, dear. Tell us, who, this particular book, have you written this for anybody in particular in mind, like the John Lennon fan, for yourself, or do you think this is a book that will just appeal to music fans overall, or just anybody who's interested in the legend that is John Lennon?
I've written all my books on musical subjects for the general reader, to explain this music and explain the people who make this music. I think they are some of the most amazing characters in recent history, some of them, not all. The music deserves absolute equality with all the great art forms in its best form. Not every, you know, maybe 2% of the total does. But I write to explain this to someone who maybe isn't, there's no one who hasn't heard of John Lennon, but someone who doesn't know this story, to explain every bit of the story from the beginning, mm-hmm. and take nothing as being known, not only about John, but about the city of Liverpool, why that's special. So it's a book for the general reader. I want to get the general reader in the first sentence and keep them till the last sentence.
And finally, obviously, that's you. You've tackled John Lennon. You've written a book about the Beatles. Are there any other Beatles on your list that you will be giving this treatment to next?
Not any other Beatles. I think Paul McCartney's own authorised biography tells the story of Paul McCartney, and that is an interesting story. There are one or two people, I suppose, left in the world of popular music. I think Frank Sinatra deserves a monumental literary biography. I think Bob Dylan does, but I can't see myself doing either one of those.
Why not? Just too daunting, or?
I don't think one will happen. I think his family wouldn't allow it to be done. Bob Dylan's always been in the business of covering his tracks, so I can't see he's going to sit down with me ever. So that rules him out too.
So your next project is, who knows?
I'm writing a musical, actually.
Oh, are you really?
Neil Sedaka.
Oh, wow.
Great songwriter.
Yes. And tell us a little bit about that, if you can.
Well, it's a musical which is due to go into production next year. It's about this man who wrote some of the happiest pop songs ever, who actually had a quite complicated career because he was wiped out by the Beatles in the early 60s, having had 9 hits, international hits, who had to fight his way back to be famous again in the 70s, and the way he did it, his determination, and also his background. He was a taxi driver's son from Brooklyn who studied classical piano, and he's a very engaging character and full of the most amazing determination to win, to keep his music going. And his music spans pop music from the 50s. He used to go out with Carole King. Mm-hmm. He wrote O Carol for Carole King, yeah. Right up to recording for Elton John in the 70s.
Wow. Goodness, you've got a busy life. Philip, thank you very much for joining us
here
at Borders.
Thank you very much.
Philip Norman's John Lennon the Life is available online at borders.co.uk for £15. That's 40% off, and is a great read for all Beatles and music fans alike. You can find loads of great offers online at Borders' new e-commerce website, available in our autumn promotions at borders.co.uk, including up to 40% off our acclaimed banned books collection. For anyone studying, there's still time to get your textbooks at up to 40% off in our fabulous and wide-ranging back-to-college titles, with savings on the Study Skills Handbook, Teach Yourself Evening Class Guides, and a variety of titles covering all subjects. We also have great offers on the latest fiction and children's books, including 40% off A Most Wanted Man by John le Carré, A Private Patient by P.D. James, and Doors Open from Ian Rankin. We also have great offers on the latest fiction and children's books, including 40% off A Most Wanted Man by John le Carré, A Private Patient by P.D. James, and Doors Open from Ian Rankin. There's also a fantastic promotion running throughout October, which is 3 for 2 on all crime fiction books and all classic fiction. This is a unique offer to the Borders website, so get online and have a browse now. Borders.co.uk. Another regular feature on the Borders podcast is to go behind the scenes to meet the buying team. They're the people responsible for what you and I find on the shelves of our Borders store. And in this edition, I met up again with the non-fiction buyer, Rob Hughes, who came armed with some great ideas for Christmas. Welcome back, Rob. Good to see you again. And this time around, we're talking about biography. Now, from what I understand, there are many chat show hosts who have new books coming out.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, it's a big week for it. I mean, obviously, coming up to Christmas is the best time for non-fiction anyway. Biographies make up a big part of that. And this week we've got two coming out on Thursday, two of the really big ones coming out on Thursday, one just out a week or so ago. Michael Parkinson is obviously the biggest one coming out. He's, as he's pitching himself, the man who's met everybody, and it's your chance to learn about those people, I guess, and how he interacted with them, what they had to say, what he really thought of them once he'd spoken to them off camera or on camera, I suppose.
Do you think that this Parky book will spill lots of beans, or do you think in typical Parky form he'll give a little bit but actually not anything we hadn't really heard before?
I think he's much too much of a diplomat to dish the dirt on anybody, to be honest. I think it's more for people who would like a look into being able, you know, being part of that circle, I guess, and just having a contact, you know, imagining what it'd be like vicariously to have a contact book as replete as Parky's. With everybody. I mean, the only person he said he didn't meet that he wanted to was Frank Sinatra. So perhaps not one for Frank fans, but everybody else, I think, should find something in there that they're interested in.
And one of the guys that kind of pitted against them, but they're very, very different, of course, and has a book coming out, is Jonathan Ross.
Jonathan Ross has got a book coming out as well, slightly more risque, I think, from everything I've heard. But that's coming out slightly later in the month, so as it comes closer to Christmas and the sales war really starts picking up, it'll be interesting to see which one is going in front, because as far as I'm concerned, those are the two biggest biographies coming out this Christmas.
And do either of them have any quirky names? Because you know some people, when they write autobiographies, they kind of give unusual names.
Well, one of them does, one of them doesn't. Parky's is, I think it's just called My Story, or The Autobiography, in rather prosaic fashion, but Jonathan Ross's is called Why Do I Say These Things? And I think if anyone who's seen his chat show will know, he's not really afraid to just say whatever comes into his head and see what the reaction he gets. Most of the time, people seem to get it, you know, he gets away with it. I think people don't seem to be too annoyed. So, that's the name of his autobiography, Why Do I Say These Things?
And somebody else who is a chat show host, very different from these two guys, and I don't really know anybody who doesn't love him, and that is Paul O'Grady.
Paul O'Grady's also got a book out, At My Mother's Knee. That came out, I think, last week, possibly the week before, but is doing fantastic business already, I think, riding really high in the bestseller charts. It's about growing up in Liverpool, about how he became Lily Savage, and then after that, his sort of transformation into a TV personality in his own right, and, as you say, a chat show host of a very different shade to both Michael Parkinson and Jonathan Ross. So I think we've got all bases covered in terms of popular presenters, definitely.
And Dawn French, and I know she's doing a final tour at the moment out on the road with Jennifer Saunders. Mm-hmm. She's got a book out. I'm kind of thinking, has she written one before?
Well, she's obviously had a hand in writing French and Saunders script books that have come out. To the best of my knowledge, this is the first autobiography she's written. Again, something of a quirky title. It's called Dear Fatty. And is written, as far as I understand it, in the form of letters to pretty much everyone she's met throughout her life, her parents, people she knew at school, her teachers, Lenny Henry, her husband, obviously. And from what I understand, she's written the whole thing out in longhand before either not dictating it like a lot of people do or even typing it. She's written the whole thing out in longhand and then got someone else to type it up for her. But I think that's, again, going to be quite a different spin on the autobiography genre, if you like, because of its epistolatory nature.
And also, I tell you what, the one thing I do like about Dawn French is that she just is quite happy to have a pop at herself, and quite clearly with a title like Dear Fatty, she hasn't got a problem.
Yeah, very much so, very much so. I don't think she's not backwards and coming forwards in that way at all.
So there are four books. Typically, we kind of know what we're going to expect with those books, except, as you say, with Dawn French, which is a little bit different. But somebody who's got another book coming out, and I can't believe how many this guy manages to put together, and I do like him, but you think, God, where does he get the time? And that is Jamie Oliver.
Jamie Oliver has his new book out on Thursday as well, The Ministry of Food is its title. It ties in with a TV series that starts, I think, either this week or next. Very different in nature to his previous Jamie at Home, which kind of gave everybody the rural idyllic lifestyle, filmed at his house or mansion, apparently, in Essex, with acres of gardens and what have you. This is very much a different thing altogether. from what I gather, he has, again, tried to take on a real active role in changing the nation's eating habits by going and spending time with people who are on very low incomes, people who've had no experience of cooking, people who don't have any confidence in following recipes at all, and trying to help them and show them that, in fact, you know, just because they've got very young children, maybe they bring them up on their own, they don't have to feed them fast food all the time, but in fact they can cook on their own very easily and with very little money.
Yeah, Jamie Oliver is really very good at reinventing himself and, of course, bringing new things to us. Now, as you said before, it's a huge week, a huge time for new releases on the run-up to Christmas in this particular category. Anything else you just want to bring to our attention?
Well, there is, there's Bradley Wiggins, the multi-Olympic gold medalist, also has a book out. I think there's going to be a lot of interest in that after how well our cyclist performed in Beijing. Julie Walters, a host of other Hollywood stars, Tony Curtis, Roger Moore. Bizarrely, the cheetah from the Tarzan films also has an autobiography out, written from the chimp's point of view, as I'm led to believe. So that could be a left-field choice, I think, definitely sort of sneaking up on the outside, that one.
So plenty of books, new books for us to pick up if everybody's starting to even do their Christmas shopping. It's a little bit early, I know, but we have to think about these things. So check out online, borders.co.uk, or, of course, you can check out all the new titles in-store. Rob, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And just before I go, don't forget to pre-order your copy of the brand new J.K. Rowling book, The Tales of Beedle the Bard. It's the first new J.K. Rowling book to be published since Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows. You can pre-order now for £3.99 and get your two free books and secure a much-valued early edition of the book, only in-store and at borders.co.uk. That brings us to the end of this Borders podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. Remember to check back in 2 weeks' time at borders.co.uk for the next podcast, which will be packed full of more interviews and news from the world of books, music and DVD, as well, of course, those competitions and offers. And remember, if you'd like to listen to previous podcasts, you can do that by visiting the website borders.co.uk/podcast. I'm Susan Spence, and on behalf of all the team at Borders, thank you for listening.